So our Bible reading says from selections from Job, beginning at chapter 38. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me, if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? Or who laid its cornerstone, while the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy? Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea, or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me, if you know all this, what is the way to the abode of light? And where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwellings? Surely you know, for you were already born. You have lived so many years." Then Job answered the Lord, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more." Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm, "Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's, and can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor, and clothe yourself in honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at all who are proud and bring them low. Look at all who are proud and humble them. Crush the wicked where they stand. Bury them all in the dust together. Shroud their faces in the grave. Then I myself will admit to you that your own right hand can save you. Look at Behemoth, which I made along with you, and which feeds on grass like an ox. What strength it has in its loins, what power in the muscles of its belly. Can anyone capture it by the eyes, or trap it and pierce its nose? Can you pull in Leviathan with a fish hook, or tie down its tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through its nose or pierce its jaw with a hook? Will it keep begging you for mercy? Will it speak to you with gentle words? Will it make an agreement with you for you to take it as your slave for life? No one is fierce enough to rouse it. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me."
Good morning, everyone. As the kids were heading out just before, Luke suggested we discuss this question. What would you do if you were God for a day? So I wonder what things came to your mind. But the idea of a human being being God for a day has already been played out by Hollywood in the film Bruce Almighty. In this film, Jim Carrey, he portrays television reporter Bruce Nolan. When he finds out that he's been overlooked for a promotion, Bruce loses his temper on air and he's fired. He later screams out to God, "The only one around here not doing his job is you." Bruce then meets God, portrayed by Morgan Freeman, who endows Bruce with all of his powers to see if he can do a better job. Somewhat predictably, Bruce uses his newfound powers for personal gain. Makes his favourite hockey team win the championship, causes his professional rival to get fired so he can take over his job. He then causes miraculous events like a meteor strike to happen so he can go and report on them exclusively. In the midst of all this fun, Bruce also starts hearing voices in his head. God has to explain to him that the voices are prayers. To deal with this, Bruce creates an email system to receive the prayers, but there's too many. He hasn't got time for that. So he sets the email system to automatically answer every prayer, yes. But Bruce soon learns that his actions have consequences. His city is driven into chaos, as some believe the apocalypse is imminent. The meteor strike is a sure sign of this. And then there's the large number of people all having prayed to win the lottery and received $17 in return. Well, they've started rioting. What really hits home is the realization that even with his divine powers, Bruce can't make people love him against their free will. Turns out doing God's job is a bit harder than Bruce expected. Now, perhaps you wouldn't be as self-centered as Bruce was if you had divine powers. But regardless, I should apologize for prompting Luke to ask you all this question and lead you down the garden path. Because when we question how God rules the world, when we question how God could allow injustice and suffering to occur, when we begin to think that we could or would do a better job, do God's job differently to him, we arrogantly forget our place. And it's this arrogance that Job chapters 38 to 41 seeks to humble and correct. So here's the big idea of today's talk up front. Job 38 to 41, Yahweh appears and puts Job in his place. Through a series of long questions, God clearly establishes that he alone is creator and Lord, who is without rival or equal. And Job, well, he is just a mere human being. And so these chapters, they inspire Job and us to live with wisdom, to fear the Lord, praising, worshipping, revering him in wonderment at his unparalleled supremacy. He alone established creation, sustains everything within it. Then on the other side of the coin, our fear of the Lord, reverence for him, drives us to humble ourselves, to recognize our place as creatures subject to the Creator. So having told you today's big idea up front, let's now step through the chapters and see how we get through to this conclusion. So from the beginning of the book of Job, we're introduced to Job, the man who is blameless, a righteous person. His life reflects wisdom and integrity. Then taken behind the scenes into the heavenly courtroom, where the accuser Satan challenges God. Does Job love God for who he is, or simply just for what he provides? Well, God then allows Satan to test Job's faith. Job experiences the devastating loss of his possessions, his children, and his health. Yet even as his world collapses around him, Job initially responds with grief, honesty, and worship, choosing to trust God even when he doesn't understand. From there, the book goes into this cycle of speeches between Job and his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, as they wrestle with understanding the nature of God and his justice, because their worldview is that good things happen to good people. God, he blesses the righteous. But bad things, they happen to bad people. God punishes the wicked. And so the friends, they conclude that what has happened is God's discipline and justice in response to Job's wickedness. So they urge Job to repent so that his good fortune may be restored. Yet Job, he resolutely maintains his innocence. Now, he doesn't believe he's perfect, totally without sin, but his worldview has been shaken. God has allowed bad things to happen to him, a good person. He doesn't understand how God could unjustly allow him to suffer. And so he asserts that if he had his day in court, if he could present his case before the face of God, he would prove his innocence. He'd win the day against the God who has persecuted him. And so as Job and his friends go back and forth, digging their heels in a little further each time, one of the central tenets of the book emerges. Who is wise? Is it Job? Is it the friends? And as we heard last week, Job chapter 28, humans have this incredible ability to search the earth and uncover its riches and its resources. But wisdom cannot be found in the same way. God alone knows the way to wisdom. He alone gives it to those who fear him, who trust and honor him, turn to him from evil, even when life is confusing and painful. So today, arriving at chapter 38, Job finally gets what he desired all along, an audience with Yahweh. And so what might we expect to happen in this encounter? Will God explain to Job the reason for his suffering? That it's been in response to a challenge from Satan, and God has allowed a good man to suffer in order to test his faith? Or will it be Job who is the one doing the talking, cross-examining God, presenting his case before him so that he can be vindicated, just as he has claimed all along? Well, the fact that God appears to Job, speaks to him out of a whirling, ferocious storm, gives us a good indication that what comes next is going to be powerful and unsettling. God's opening words to Job set the tone, assert his sovereign power. Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Job has been longing for an audience with God. Already it's not going the way he anticipated. Instead of Job questioning God, it is God who will question Job. And what follows in the next few chapters is over 80 rhetorical questions that seek to teach Job and us that God alone is creator and Lord, who is without rival or equal. And so in the first series of questions, God sets out to convince Job that he created the world in wisdom and that he governs it wisely, in justice and with compassion. God begins by asking Job where he was at creation. When God was creating the world, like a builder constructing a house, where were you, Job? God doesn't recall seeing Job around when he was setting the world on its foundations, marking out its dimensions with measuring lines, laying the cornerstone. Next series of questions concern the origin of the sea. In contrast to a typical ancient Near Eastern image of the sea being a symbol of fear and chaos and disorder, here the sea is personified as an infant. In language that's reminiscent of the Genesis creation account, God reminds Job that he is the one who has skillfully, intentionally birthed the sea into existence. He took care of the sea like an infant, swaddling the sea with clouds and mists. He confines the chaos of the sea by marking off its boundaries with authority. The connections to the Genesis creation account continue in the next series of questions, where the emphasis there shifts to light and darkness. Creation began with God speaking light into existence. Each new day has begun at the Lord's command. And just as God confined the chaos of the sea, so too he confines the wicked by shaking them out from underneath the veil of darkness. God continues inquiring about Job's acquaintance with the extremities of creation. Has Job ever journey to the great depths of the sea, comprehended the vast expanses of the earth, entered into the great storehouses of heaven? The four-person crew of the recent Artemis II space expedition, well, they can boast that they've set the human record for distance from Earth at a distance of over 406,000 kilometers. Pretty good. But in terms of the expanses of the universe, it's really only scratching the surface. There's still so much more in the heights, the breadth, the depths of creation that we haven't explored. But God has. So having demonstrated that He alone established creation, God's line of questioning now shifts to address the way in which He governs and maintains creation. God begins His account for His wise and judicious maintenance of the world by looking at the way in which He governs the elements. Between the heavenly storehouses and the earth, He cuts a channel for the rain, the dew, the frost, so that each arrive at His command and in its season. God's generosity and wisdom in caring for the entire world is shown in that He even sends rain to the uninhabited desolate lands so that they too may bring forth life. God then inquires as to Job's capacity to command the heavens. The movement of the stars indicate time. They can announce the seasons. They can be used to chart direction. Can Job affect the movement of the stars, the constellations of the Pleiades, the Orion, the Bear, so that they rise and they set at his command? If so, he might be able to alter the course of earthly affairs, including his own suffering and distress. But of course he cannot. The movement of these constellations exclusively falls under God's dominion and the laws that he has established. And after claiming mastery over the heavenly elements, God then reflects on his unrivaled knowledge and mastery over the animal world. It's God who provides food for the lion and the raven. Only God knows when the mountain goat and the deer give birth to their young. And in God's wisdom, he has given different traits to different creatures. To the wild donkey and the ox, he has given great strength, a desire for freedom that no human can restrain or domesticate. God, however, is their master and sustainer. In his wisdom, he has withheld flight and wisdom from the ostrich, yet endowed it with astonishing speed so that it laughs as it races past the horse and rider. In his wisdom, he gives the warhorse strength, fearless courage. In his wisdom, God has equipped the hawk and the eagle with the sight and the wings to have dominion over the skies. Each of these animals contribute to the variety, the beauty of the world order. The way that God cares for, provides for each of these creatures, testifies to his wise goodness. And if God is Lord of the wild animals that inhabit the desolate wastelands, the isolated cliffs, he assuredly is in full control of the inhabited world, particularly the affairs of human beings. And so having presented his position that he alone is creator and Lord who established and governs the creation with wisdom and understanding, God invites Job to present his case. We might expect that Job has plenty to say at this point. After all, Job has been advocating the rightness of his position so tenaciously to his friends, being so confident that if the very opportunity that he had, that's now before him, if he had that opportunity, he would question God. He'd prove his innocence. He'd be vindicated. But amazingly, the formerly loquacious Job has been reduced to a few words. Recognizing his minute stature, his own insignificance before the Almighty, he slaps his hand over his mouth. Perhaps at this point, he's following Mark Twain's proverbial wisdom. Better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak and remove all doubt. And so while Job has nothing new to say, he also does not renounce the position that he has taken once, yet even twice. He continues to stand behind his declaration of innocence, even if his confidence of winning a debate against God is diminishing. But given that God launches into a second lengthy speech, it's fair to conclude that Job's response is wholly inadequate. when you've challenged the wisdom and justice of the Creator and Lord of the universe, and He demands an answer from you, slapping your hand over your mouth isn't going to cut it. And so God continues to challenge Job out of the whirling storm. While his first speech, it focused on God's establishment and maintenance of creation, the second speech focuses on God's sovereignty and power, and it does so in two parts. The first part, chapter 40, verses 7 to 14, God questions Job about his power, challenges him to rule like a king. God essentially says to Job, since you think I'm not doing my job very well, that I'm not ruling with justice, show me that you can do it better. Show me that you can exercise power and authority. Show me that you can adorn yourself with glory and splendor. And show me that you can humble the proud and crush the wicked. You can do all that, Job. I'll concede to you. But unlike Bruce Almighty, God isn't going to give Job a leg up. And so without any divine powers being bestowed upon him, this is a challenge to which Job obviously falls short. He has neither the power nor the authority to rule like a divine king. And so he's reminded of his place in the cosmic pecking order. And if not yet convinced of the need to abandon his complaint and avoid the fundamental sin of usurping God's place, blurring the line between creator and creature, God quizzes Job about the most powerful beasts of the land and the sea, Behemoth and Leviathan. And given the lengthy descriptions of these great and powerful creatures, it's easy to get lost in the weeds of speculation, trying to identify these creatures. Is Behemoth a hippo, a water buffalo, an elephant, a dinosaur? Is Leviathan a crocodile, some kind of serpentine sea monster? Well, the best approach to take is that Behemoth and Leviathan are representative creatures. They're representing the ultimate in land animals, sea creatures. Formidable in size and strength, the apex of their domains. They have no fear, no equal. And so the suggestion that any human being could domesticate these creatures is laughable. Yet as formidable as these powerful beasts are, they are still creatures. And so, like all other creatures, big and small and in between, they are totally subservient to their one master, to their maker. The final verse we read today from chapter 41, verse 11, it says this, "Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me." Everything under heaven belongs to the Lord. God alone is the Creator and Lord who rules with wisdom, understanding, justice and power. He is without rival or equal. And so if Job's first response was wholly inadequate, how then should we adequately respond to Job chapter 38 to 41? Well, as Luke will cover for us next week in Job's final response, chapter 42, we must recognize our place as creatures in relation to the Creator, as subjects in relation to the Lord. It's by fearing the Lord, being in awe and reverence of Him, and so humbly accepting our position within the created order, that we can begin to live with wisdom. The book of Job, and particularly chapters 38 to 41, teach us that some things are and will always be beyond our understanding as finite human beings. And the reason why we or someone we care about is suffering very well may be among those things that are beyond our understanding. Yet at the same time, we learn from these chapters in Job that having the answers to the reasons for suffering is not a prerequisite for faith. God's speeches don't direct Job towards the reasons for his suffering, They direct Job towards the God whom he is to fear and trust and serve. And so Job chapters 38 to 41 challenge us to consider if we are putting ourselves up on a pedestal, thinking the universe revolves around us. It asks us if we've crept into thinking and acting like we are God, and so lost the divide between creator and creature. If so, best to humble ourselves, get down off the pedestal, recognize our place as creatures subject to the Creator and Lord, who is without rival or equal. That's when we do that, that's when we begin to live and walk in the ways of wisdom.